Okay, she said. On my knees, I added. Okay. And we both have to be naked. Adrian, she said warningly. We'll discuss the terms later, I said with a wink. But I felt a pang in my heart as I squeezed the rings and let go of her hands, hating the danger she was about to walk into. Her appearance might be different, but her aura shone to me like no one else's, so brave despite the dangers ahead. I wanted so badly to go with her, but knew there was nothing I could do there. My biggest help would be with Alicia when the witches unfroze her. We should grab something to eat and then hit the road, Sabrina said.
Hope you like Oreos and cheese puffs, Eddie told her.
We ate a bizarre meal of junk food while Sabrina elaborated on a few more things for us. We're going to Calexico down by the border, she said, but you're not supposed to know that. We have to keep up appearances. Once we go in, we'll probably be separated, but I'll be around. They'll also let me keep my phone so I can send messages to Marcus.
And you'll then update me, right? I said.
Marcus gave me a tight smile.
Right, don't worry. Sabrina will look after them.
It was a hollow reassurance, since we all knew things could go very, very badly at the Warrior's place, and that Sabrina would probably be able to do very little. In her usual way, Sydney was more concerned about me as they were leaving.
Be careful, Adrian. I want to find Jill too, but not at the cost of losing you.
It'll be remedial compulsion, I assured her. You're the one walking into a hornet's nest.
This is what we do, she said simply. You have your job, I have mine.
She stood on her tiptoes to give me a light kiss on the cheek. No way was I settling for that. With a quick maneuver, I swept her into my arms and gave her a long, deep kiss goodbye, not caring about the witnesses. When she finally pulled back, that new face was blushing in a very Sydney way, but she stayed in my arms.
I can't say I didn't expect that, she admitted.
This is it, I told her. We're on the verge of getting Jill back. Once we get that, we'll secure our freedom and finally get that happily ever after.
How exactly are you going to manage that? Demanded Aunt Tatiana. Living back at court? With those keepers in Michigan?
I had a feeling Sydney was full of the same questions, but she didn't speak any of them aloud. Instead, her face showed only love and hope as she gave me another parting kiss. The next thing I knew, Sabrina was ushering them out to her car to begin this bizarre adventure. I stood with Marcus in the doorway, gazing off into the night, even after they were gone. I hope this is a good plan, I said to him, my heart aching. Marcus sighed, and for once, his usual optimistic expression looked weary. It must be hard constantly convincing people that every risky thing he came up with would pay off.
Good doesn't enter into it, he admitted. It's the only plan we've got.
Chapter 15. Sydney. Calexico was a little less than 2 hours away, which made for a long and strange journey. When we were halfway there, Sabrina stopped to blindfold us, per warrior protocol. For the rest of the trip, she repeated information we'd already memorized, information that we could never get enough of as we braced ourselves for this strange endeavor. I managed to hold on to that Zen state, focusing solely on Jill and my purpose here, remaining empty of all emotion. I especially tried hard not to worry too much about Adrian. I knew if I did, I'd falter. Instead, I took in Sabrina's advice and insight, meshing it with what I knew I had to do. I felt oddly cool and detached. Then we reached the Warrior's compound. Sabrina warned us it was coming as the car slowed for the compound's gate. I heard the window roll down.
Sabrina Woods, she said, bringing two potential recruits.
Two, huh?
A gravelly voice responded back, sounding more amused than concerned. Sabrina herself remained perfectly calm.
I didn't bring any last year, making up for it, I guess.
Take him to the holding area,
came the response. The window rolled up, and Sabrina slowly accelerated. A heavy exhalation of relief was the only sign that she was more nervous about this endeavor than she'd let on. I heard the tires crunching on gravel, and a minute later,
The car came to a stop. She turned it off and opened her door.
"Everyone out,"
she said. She guided us from the car toward the sound of people speaking. Here, at last, our blindfolds were removed. The desert landscape was scrubby and barren and contained a collection of ramshackle buildings. It kind of reminded me of Wolf's setup, except much more run down. Two hulking guys with guns strapped to them were chatting amiably with each other in front of the door to a large building, though their faces hardened when they saw us approach. Sabrina repeated what she'd said at the gate, adding this time, "They're brother and sister." One of the guys seemed to like this.
"This is a family organization, after all."
That wasn't exactly what came to mind when I thought of the Warriors, but I gave him a smile I hoped came across as tough and cool. The guards patted us down, searching us for weapons or tracking equipment. Their examination was brisk and thankfully not lewd in any way. Eddie and I had made sure to leave our phones with Howie, and after finding nothing suspect, one of the guards waved us on through the door behind them. Sabrina started to follow, but a guard shook his head.
"They go on alone," he said. "You go through the spectator's door on the other side."
Sabrina had warned us we'd eventually get separated, so I tried not to let my panic show as she gave us a casual farewell and wished us luck. Eddie and I stepped through the doorway, which led us into an open, dusty arena, not unlike where I'd been when the Warriors were holding Sonya. It looked as though it was originally intended for baseball or soccer, but something told me that wouldn't be happening today. A few dozen other people lingered in the arena. Some were in groups, some were pointedly solo, and eyeing everyone else as potential enemies. Some looked like ordinary people you'd run into at the mall. Others practically had, "Yes, I want to join a fanatical vampire-hating group," stamped across their foreheads. All of them were around our age, give or take a few years. The gender split was almost even, slightly favoring guys. Out in the stands, other people were beginning to filter in and take seats. I caught sight of Sabrina and gave her a quick nod before turning my attention back to Eddie. "She said things start at sunrise," I told him. To the east, the sky was a burning orange, and the rest of it carried a light purple hue. Technically, we're already there.
"Your guess is as good as mine as to how this will unfold,"
he said, his sharp Dampier eyes scanning rapidly around as he spoke. Even in casual situations, his natural tendency was to watch for threats. In a high-stakes situation like this, he was constantly on edge. "I just hope we're able to..." My words were cut off by the sound of a trumpet. We all turned in its direction and saw three men wearing yellow robes and golden helmets. I stiffened, earning a quick look of concern from Eddie. "What's wrong?" he whispered. "I mean, aside from the obvious."
"I know two of them. Master Angeletti and Master Ortega. They were at the last gathering."
"Remember? They can't recognize you." I nodded, but seeing those familiar faces set me on edge. I expected at any moment one of them would point in my direction and declare me an enemy, sending all of these wannabe recruits my way. But the two masters paid me no more attention than they did any of the other recruits. When the third man, the trumpeter, stopped playing, Master Angeletti spoke, his voice still deep and his gray beard still scraggly.
"Do you see that?"
he asked, raising his hands toward the rising sun.
"That is why we are here. What gives us all life? The sun. The light. We were born to the light. Born to goodness. It reminds me of one of my favorite psalms. Humans are born into the light. Shining good. Shining bright. Only evil thrives at night. Let us banish them from our sight."
I nearly choked with laughter, hearing poetry I probably could have written when I was 10 years old. But Master Angeletti's face was full of rapture as he spoke, and the other warriors nodded along approvingly. like he was quoting one of Shakespeare's sonnets.
"That is the natural way of things,"
Master Angeletti told us.
"Those who thrive in darkness are not part of the divine plan. They are evil and unnatural, and it is the job of our army to eliminate them and save mankind."
Beside him, Master Ortega took a turn.
"All of you are here because you have shown interest in eradicating that darkness, and because your sponsors think you may be worthy to join us. But make no mistake, we will be the ones to decide who truly deserves to serve among us. It will not be easy. You will be tested and scrutinized, your very soul examined. If any of you are afraid or know you won't have the stamina to face what's to come, I invite you to leave now."
Silence fell as he looked around expectantly. A few of the other recruits shifted their stances, but no one made any motions to leave.
"Very well, then,"
boomed Master Ortega.
"Let the trials begin!"
If I'd ever wondered about the fundamental difference between the alchemists and the warriors, I soon had my answer. Whatever their flaws, the alchemists were almost always adherents of the think-first-act-later mindset. The warriors, not so much. Once the opening formalities were out of the way, Master Ortega handed things over to the recruiting director, who, to my complete astonishment, turned out to be Chris Juarez, Trey's cousin. I hadn't seen him since the warriors had held Sonya, and Trey didn't really talk about his family after they disowned him. Trey had humiliated them by dating a Dompier. Chris had apparently walked the straight and narrow, earning this esteemed position. He strutted out in front of us now, dressed simply in jeans and a muscle shirt that showed off his well-built physique.
"You wouldn't be here if you weren't interested in ridding the world of evil," he told us. "And we'll eventually determine just how interested you are. But before we get to that, we need to see if you can hold your own if it comes down to facing that evil. Are you afraid of pain? Are you afraid of getting dirty? Are you afraid of doing whatever it takes to keep humanity in the light?"
His volume grew louder with each shouted question, stirring spectators and recruits alike into a frenzy. Some of the people standing near Eddie and me shouted back answers. One guy simply let out a primal battle scream that earned cheers from those in the stand. Me, I mostly tried to show excitement and interest, as opposed to the actual shock and disgust I felt. While Chris had been speaking, other warriors had been setting up the arena with an odd assortment of items. Wooden boxes, tin cans, buckets, cinder blocks. I wondered if there was some sort of obstacle course in the works. When they finished that task, they came out to all the recruits and gave us each a wooden heart attached to a cord. My assumed name, Fiona Gray, was written on it. Eddie, going by Fred Gray, also received one.
"This represents your heart, your life," said Chris. "Right now, we need to know who wants this the most, who's willing to do whatever it takes to be the victor. Ladies, please step aside and take seats over there."
He pointed to a section of the stands.
"You guys, go find spots wherever you want."
I met Eddie's eyes briefly as we turned to each other before parting. "Good luck," I said.
"No luck needed with this lot,"
he replied. I smiled at that and sat down beside a surly-looking girl who was about a head taller than me and nearly as muscled as Chris. There were about 30 male recruits, and they scattered throughout the arena, taking positions they thought would be most strategic. Some stood on the crates, some staked out items that looked like they could be made into weapons, like the cinder blocks. Eddie based his position on those of the other combatants, selecting a place that gave him space and a good vantage.
"For the next hour,"
Chris announced,
"your goal is to collect as many of your opponent's hearts as possible, by any means necessary. Everything in this arena is fair game. Any tactic is fair game, though we do ask that you try not to kill anyone. The six competitors with the most hearts at the end of the hour will advance. If at any time you feel incapable of going on, simply retreat over to that bench."
He pointed at another section of the stands where a man in a red hat stood.
"And place both palms down. That will release you from the challenge. And Bart will give you any first aid needed."
Bart, in a plaid shirt and ripped up jeans, didn't strike me as someone who'd had any official medical training. But maybe appearances were deceiving. My stomach was in knots as Chris asked if there were any questions and checked to make sure everyone was ready. Sabrina had warned us there'd be some sort of physical competition, but she hadn't known the specifics. They changed year to year so that no sponsor could warn their recruits in advance. Apparently, the Warriors wanted things to stay fair, which seemed ironic considering the drugged and worn-down state they'd had Sonya in before bringing her to an attempted execution. Chris held up his hand to mark the start, and a tense silence filled the air. Eddie leaned forward, squarely in his zone, eyes sharp and body ready.
"Begin!"
yelled Chris, bringing his hand down. What followed next was chaos. The guys fell on each other like a pack of dogs, fighting for a scrap of meat. Some went for full-on bodily contact, attempting to throw each other to the ground and steal hearts. Other competitors took a more savage approach, hurling cinder blocks and wielding other debris as weapons. Most of my attention stayed on Eddie, who took a calmer approach and waited for people to come after him. His strength wasn't initially obvious, and many thought he'd be easy prey. Their mistaken beliefs were soon corrected as he dispatched one attacker after another, knocking them out with precision punches and kicks, then collecting their hearts afterward. Losing your heart didn't mean you were out of the competition. If you could recover your heart or simply have a majority at the end of the hour, it was all good. Some of those Eddie took hearts from attempted recovery. Others moved on to seemingly easier foes. My real heart, the one in my chest, thudded as I watched Eddie. I needed him to stay in the competition. I needed us both to. So far, there didn't seem to be any cause to worry. He was clearly faster and stronger than most people out there. Plus, he had the seasoning and experience to make use of his gifts. Others, though strong, had no real skills and simply relied on brute force, which proved effective in some cases. I saw one guy slam a wooden plank into another's knee, causing the victim to crumple in pain and scream as he fell. His attacker snatched away the victory heart, ignoring his opponent's pleas for help in getting to Bart in first aid. Eddie happened to be passing by at the time and paused to help the fallen guy get to the bench. Another guy, the one who'd let out the earlier primal scream, was also making pretty short work of his competition. His muscles bulged grotesquely, making me wonder if he took steroids or simply lived in a gym. He apparently had some fans in the audience, because they shouted his name each time he captured a heart.
"Caleb! Caleb! Go Caleb!"
Caleb flashed a malicious grin at his fans as he stormed through the arena, looking for new prey. Although his own strength was powerful unaided, he still sometimes utilized a cinder block as an asset. I wasn't alone in gasping when he slammed it into some guy's head, instantly knocking the guy to the ground. Caleb swept up the three hearts his victim wore and went on his way. Bart himself came out to drag the fallen back to the safety of the stands, and I didn't really start breathing again until I saw the poor guy limply move an arm. Two other guys had arrived together, like Eddie and me, and were teaming up to take out foes and split the hearts between them. It was a smart strategy, and I wished Eddie and I could have utilized it. The Warriors had some outdated hang-ups about men and women, and although there were female competitors, Sabrina had explained that girls in the Warriors were often kept out of the line of danger and relegated to milder roles. I wasn't sure if I should applaud the warriors for showing some sign of consideration or be offended that they didn't think women could keep up with men in bloodthirsty brutality. As the hour wound down, about half of the competitors were gone from the fray, off getting whatever medical attention Bart could administer. A few guys were clearly dominant, notably Eddie, Caleb, and the twosome. Those remaining were trying to pick off each other or go after one of the leaders. Chris shouted a 5-minute warning, and one guy, desperately realizing he was nearly out of the running, made a frantic charge at Caleb in the hopes of securing a massive stash of hearts. Caleb knocked him away like he was a fly, then kicked him when he was down on the ground, despite the guy's pleas to stop.
"Just take them! Just take them!"
The guy on the ground frantically tried to pull the hearts off his head and hand them over while Caleb just kept kicking. The nausea in my stomach reared up again until Caleb finally left the guy in peace. He stalked off, his gaze falling on Eddie. But thankfully, Chris called time just then. Everyone leaned forward, eager to find out the results. Unsurprisingly, Caleb and Eddie had the most, followed by three other guys I hadn't paid much attention to. The two who'd worked together were tied for the 6th-place spot. I wondered if the Warriors would accept 7 victors, but after deliberating with the Masters, Chris selected only one as the winner. He congratulated the other, encouraging him to try again next year. I hadn't noticed the guy who'd won, Wayne, doing anything particularly different from his friend in fighting. Wayne was, however, much bigger and better built. Something told me the Warriors put a lot of emphasis on physical appearances, probably assuming that he who looked the strongest would be the strongest. That didn't bode well for me, because when the girls were called up, 13 of us, it was clear I was the smallest and the least buff-looking of them all. Things worsened when Chris announced that only 2 girls would advance and that they would be determined based on whoever had the most hearts at the end of the hour. Eddie and I exchanged brief glances across the arena at that. 2 girls? That wasn't much of a safety net, especially when it was imperative that I, more than Eddie, stick around to search out information about Jill's whereabouts. He gave me a tight smile and nodded encouragingly, seeming to say, "Well then, just make sure you've got the most hearts." Right. No problem. Seeing the guys compete first had given us some sense of what the best strategy might be. We positioned ourselves in the arena, a number of the girls immediately moving toward potential weapons. I saw a few of them eye me, as the smallest, and I readied myself for defense. In some ways I welcomed it, as that was what I'd focused on the most with Wolf. But defense wouldn't win me any hearts. I wasn't violent by nature. Offense was second nature to Eddie, and he'd had an easier time slipping into that role. Chris started the match, and chaos once again ensued. 2 girls immediately headed for me. Blood pounded in my ears, and a cool sense of purpose slowly slid into place as I drew on all of Wolf's lessons. I stayed out of their reach, ducking their brutish and often clumsy advances. It seemed to frustrate them when I didn't prove to be an easy victim, and eventually they got in each other's way. With a snarl, they turned on each other, both falling into the dirt in a tangle of hitting and hair-pulling. One emerged victorious, carrying the other's heart, and charged toward me. Finally, I allowed myself to give in to the fight and astonished her with a punch that sent her stumbling backward as my magic-infused strength coursed through me. I had that same strange sense as before, that the strength was both part of me and yet not part of me. But soon I fell into its rhythm. After a few more failed attacks, the girl yielded and gave me her hearts. I looked around, uncertain of my next move. I knew I needed to just go up and attack someone, but it was still a weird and unfamiliar sensation. "You're playing a role, Sydney," I told myself. "Get into it. Don't feel bad. Remember what these people are, what they might have done to Jill." I was spared from choosing my next victim when another girl decided my earlier victory was a lucky break. A similar process followed, with me engaging in a long game of self-defense. "The best fight is the one you avoid," Wolf had always said. I led my foe on a merry chase, and when she finally grew impatient and lunged for me, I was able to trip her up and effectively pin her to the ground. Her ankle twisted as she went down, and I was able to take her heart with little resistance. It was also clear she was out of commission, and although I felt a little guilty about that, I was relieved to be responsible for an injury that would only require a little recuperation. Based on the screams of those around me, others wouldn't be so lucky. That left me with 3 hearts, and I felt rather proud. A glance over at Eddie, sitting near the other male victors, told me I shouldn't feel so cocky. He gestured frantically, the message loud and clear. Pick up the pace. My pro-defense tactic was keeping me safe, but not racking up the hearts. A quick reconnaissance told me others had more hearts than I did, but before I could choose my next course of action, the decision was taken from me. The girl who'd sat near me, the big bulky one, came at me full force. We collided and fell to the ground. Her fist closed around the cords around my neck, and she pulled, nearly choking me in the process. That magical strength surged within me, and with one big push, I knocked her off of me and scrambled to my feet. She too rose and eyed me speculatively, clearly surprised at the hidden force beneath my small exterior. Chris shouted the 5-minute warning. I braced for the tall girl to come at me, but then, with a quick shrug, she turned away and headed towards someone else. It took me only a moment to understand why. She clearly had the most hearts of any girl. With time nearly up, she wasn't going to risk losing them to someone who'd surprised her with a big show of strength. She'd play it safe and let the clock run out. A few other girls were in contention for second place and suddenly grew more frenzied in their attacks. Me? I was squarely in third. Except there was no third place. I met Eddie's eyes again and saw true concern now. Then, my gaze slid to the person sitting beside him in the stands. Caleb, smug and secure in his position. Without thinking twice, I strode over and jerked Caleb up by his shirt. That magical strength burned through me, matching us far more evenly than we would ever have been in normal circumstances. Catching him by surprise gave me an extra edge. I landed a punch that would have made Wolf proud and then kicked at his knee. I didn't break anything, but Caleb did trip and fall to the ground. I quickly pulled the hearts from around his neck and sidestepped as he swung a fist toward me and roared in rage. Eddie jumped up, quick to defend me, but by then, Chris was calling time. He hurried over to us, frowning at the unorthodox behavior.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?"
he demanded. "Winning," I said. I held up my original 3 hearts with the mass I'd stolen from Caleb. "You said the winning girls would be picked based on whoever had the most hearts at the end of our hour. That's me." Chris flushed at being trapped in his words.
"Yeah, but..."
"And you said any tactic is fair game."
"But..."
"And," I continued triumphantly, "you asked if we were willing to do anything in the fight against evil. I am. Even if it means facing someone bigger and stronger, which those vampiric demons obviously will be." I waved a dismissive hand at the other female competitors, who were staring open-mouthed. "What's the point of going up against them?" A shocked silence hung around us. Then it was replaced by laughter. Master Angeletti made his way toward us, through the stands, careful not to trip on his golden robes. His face was filled with mirth.
"She has a point, Juarez. She outsmarted you, and I say if she can do that, and take down our biggest male competitor, she's earned her spot."
Caleb turned beet red.
"I didn't give her all I had. She's just a girl."
Master Angeletti waved him off.
"Relax. You can still stay. This girl, what's your name?"
"Fiona, sir. Fiona Gray."
"Fiona Gray can have one of the female spots. It looks like the other goes to that young lady over there."
Master Angeletti nodded to the tall girl, the one who'd played it safe in letting the clock run out. Her name was Tara, and although she didn't look thrilled to see me declared a victor, she made no complaint so long as she got her spot. It was the girl who would have been second place who spat out a series of obscenities my way. That seemed to amuse the warrior authorities, but they held fast in their decision. She and the other defeated recruits were dismissed. We victors were then treated to a banquet in our honor, back in what served as the compound's mess hall. The seven of us were seated at one table, while the seasoned warriors filled others. Personally, I would have preferred a shower, but at least I got the chance to sit by Eddie again. He and I grinned and nodded over our plates of ribs, as the others relived key moments from the earlier matches and talked about how we were totally going to annihilate real vampires. Most of the others seemed impressed by what I'd done to Caleb and got a good chuckle out of it. He, however, clearly wasn't amused. Throughout the meal, he shot several dark looks over to where Eddie and I sat, and I hoped I wouldn't regret my last-minute save in the arena. After lunch, the warriors decided they'd tested our penchant for brutality enough, for now, at least, and that it was time to see what kind of personalities we had. We were called one by one to come speak to the High Masters and a select group of warriors about our intentions going forward. They brought us in by alphabetical order, meaning I went before Eddie, and wasn't able to get any sort of warning of what was to come. This, at least, was pretty consistent from year to year, and Sabrina had briefed us on what to expect. Mostly a lot of interrogation, during which we'd affirm how much we hated vampires. What I wasn't expecting was how much it would remind me of re-education. Once I was seated in front of the Masters and all-male council, they directed my attention to a large screen hanging on the wall. An image of happy, ordinary-looking Maroy appeared.
"What do you see?"
asked Master Angeletti. My heart caught in my throat, and suddenly I was back in that underground prison, strapped into a chair with Sheridan's pretty but cruel face gazing down at me.
"What do you see, Sydney?"
"Maroy, ma'am."
"Wrong. You see creatures of evil."
"I don't know. Maybe they are. I'd have to know more about these particular Maroy."
"You don't need to know anything except what I've told you. They are creatures of evil."
And then she tortured me, dipping my hand in an acidic solution that felt like it was burning my flesh off, forcing me to endure the pain until I would finally agree with her and repeat that they were creatures of evil. The memory was so intense, so vivid as I sat there with the warriors, that my skin started to crawl again. The room felt like it was closing in, becoming a prison just as re-education had been, and I worried I would faint in front of them.
"Fiona?"
asked Master Angeletti, tilting his head at me. Although stern-faced, there was an indulgence to his voice, as though he thought I might be intimidated by their presence.
"What do you see?"
I swallowed, again paralyzed by fear of my past. As my silence persisted, the other warriors began looking at me curiously.
"It's an act, Sydney," I frantically told myself. "You did it then, you can do it now. This isn't re-education. You aren't trapped, and Jill's life is on the line."
Jill. It was the thought of her name, the memory of her clear and innocent face, that drew me back to life. I blinked and focused back on the screen.
"Evil, sir," I said. "I see evil things that have no part of the natural order."
And so it began. I answered in the ways Sabrina had prompted me, not that I needed much coaching. I just had to answer like I would have in re-education. I recited a cover story we'd come up with about how my brother Fred and I had been attacked by a Strigoi one night and barely gotten away with our lives. I explained how we'd tried telling the authorities, but no one would believe us. We'd known the truth of the evil we'd seen and spent the next few years searching for help, until finally we'd met Sabrina and learned of the warrior's quest. When the interview finished, the warriors were smiling reassuringly, pleased with my answers. I smiled back, but on the inside, I was a mess. I could barely stop myself from shaking or losing myself to the memories of that terrible time. I gave Eddie an encouraging nod when I was released back to the waiting room with the others, and then I sank into a chair, grateful that no one seemed interested in talking to me. I was able to sit and space for a while, studying my breathing and shaking off the memories. He returned a little while later, irritated by their line of questioning, but overall relaxed. "Psychos," he muttered to me, keeping a smile on his face for the sake of the others in the room. I stuck to the story, and they took it well.
"Same here," I said, envious of how easy it had been for him. He didn't have the baggage I had.
Once everyone had been interviewed, it was time for dinner and another banquet back in the mess hall. As we ate, Master Ortega recited a psalm and gave a long sermon about the glory of humanity and the light and how we were all doing such a great job in fighting the good fight. It was a variation of what I'd heard with the alchemists, even before re-education, and I wondered if I'd ever be free of groups of people trying to impose their beliefs on me. Fortunately, we were given some personal time afterward, and Sabrina came over to talk to us in a corner of the room. Other sponsors were meeting with their recruits, so nobody took it amiss. "Hanging in there?" she asked quietly. We nodded, and she gave me a wry smile. "Ballsy move going after Caleb."
"I thought they'd appreciate the moxie," I replied.
"Yes and no," she said. "Taking on a challenge like that does score you some points, but there are those who just don't like anyone breaking the rules."
"Sounds familiar," I said, thinking of the alchemists.
"What'll happen now?" asked Eddie. Sabrina glanced around and shrugged.
"Not much tonight. There are separate dorms for men and women, so everyone will go to bed soon. That'll be your chance to look around, Sydney. I checked out the facilities earlier today, and there aren't a lot of locked doors to deal with. You said those were a problem, right?"
"Right," I agreed. "Invisibility spells could hide me, but wouldn't do any good if someone saw a door opening by itself.
And security cameras."
She shook her head.
"There are none of those. Most security's on the perimeter of the compound. They want to keep others out and all of us in. Moving around, if they can't see you, shouldn't be too difficult for you. The areas they want protected have armed guards, which hopefully you can slip past."
"Hopefully." It was amazing that we could discuss armed guards as minor obstacles. "Except I'm just not sure where I'm going."
"I am," she said. "I found out while scouting around. If you look out the window behind me, you'll see a big gray building. That's the women's dorm. To its right is the men's dorm, and to the right again is the building where the masters have their headquarters. That's where you'll find your answers."
Eddie and I both glanced at the window indicated. He frowned.
"I hate that this is all on you. I feel useless."
I touched his arm reassuringly.
"You're my backup," I said. "I feel better having you here."
"And we may need your help when it's time to get out," added Sabrina.
I noted her use of "we."
"You'll be coming with us?" I asked.
"When you guys disappear, I'll get in trouble for bringing false recruits. Even if they don't think I'm part of a conspiracy, they'll accuse me of being sloppy. I don't want to deal with that. And honestly," she sighed, "I'm ready to be done with this job. I'll help Marcus some other way."
Our free time wrapped up, and everyone was sent off to their dorms. Chris advised us recruits in particular to get some sleep because we had a big day tomorrow. I tried not to grimace. I was already sore and scraped up from today, and my work wasn't even over. As I entered the girls' dorm, I found that Sabrina had been right. There were a lot of open doorways connecting halls and rooms. Because there was no air conditioning, many windows were left open as well. Curtains were hung in the room doorways to provide privacy, and those didn't even touch the floor. It was almost a dream come true for someone needing to sneak around invisibly, especially since there were so few women around to begin with, meaning most of the dorm wasn't in use. Unfortunately, my room wasn't empty. Someone had had the brilliant idea to put Tara and me together. She glowered at me as we got ready for bed, and made a few seemingly idle threats about how she'd prove to everyone that she was the superior candidate. She didn't seem like she'd attack me in my sleep, though. The problem was that I couldn't risk her waking and seeing my bed empty, then reporting me. That meant I had to cast a sleeping spell on her, something I'd never done before. I waited until she seemed to be sleeping naturally, then I crept out into the dark room. The curtain hanging in our doorway hung down about two-thirds of the way, allowing some light from the hall to shine in. I studied Tara's sleeping form and braced myself for the spell. It didn't require a lot of strength exactly, but it did require some complex calculations. It almost worked like a drug. The amount of magic required was dependent on the person's size. In the dim lighting, I hazarded a guess at how much she weighed. 160? Casting too weak a spell could risk her waking early, and I couldn't have that. So I erred on the side of caution and cast as I would for someone weighing 200 pounds. Her breathing deepened as the magic flowed through her, and her features seemed much more relaxed. Maybe I was doing her a favor. Maybe a night of solid sleep would help her in tomorrow's competition. Little did she know she'd soon be the only girl competing. Backing away, I cast my own spell, wrapping my body in invisibility. I put as much magic as I could into it, making sure it would last a while and not be easily broken. Once that was in place, I knelt in front of the curtained doorway and crept under, careful not to disturb the fabric. Out in the hall, a guard with a gun stood nearby, stifling a yawn. He clearly didn't expect much of a disturbance tonight. I walked past him easily, right over to an open window, and climbed out into the darkness, off to explore the depths of the warrior's camp.
Chapter 16. Adrian. I had trouble sleeping after Sydney left. I couldn't shake my fears about what kind of danger she was walking into, and how I couldn't be there to protect her. It didn't matter that she was brave and clever and competent, and probably better at protecting me than I was her. The urge to look out for her was just too strong. I also had trouble sleeping because my bed was a giant beanbag.
"You sure you don't want the couch?" asked Marcus.
I shook my head and gave the beanbag a couple of half-hearted punches to get it into shape. "You take it," I said. "I don't know if I could fall asleep under any conditions." He grinned.
"Howie probably has something to help you sleep."
"No thanks," I said with a snort. Marcus shut out the lights and curled up on the mustard-yellow couch. Silence fell, aside from the occasional faint strains of Mr. Tambourine Man coming from the basement. I shifted a few times, trying to get comfortable, but having little success. I tried to turn my thoughts from Sydney toward thinking about tomorrow, when I'd be helping the witches interrogate Alicia. Those weren't exactly calming thoughts, but they at least helped me channel my emotions into something besides anxiety. Before she'd left, Maud had said someone would come pick me up tomorrow evening to take me to where Alicia was being held. Apparently, they were busy securing a location and also trying to figure out a way to slip Ms. Terwilliger out without the spying alchemists following her. Amazingly, despite all the crazy conditions, I did finally fall asleep. And even more incredibly, I found myself being swept into a spirit dream by someone else. As a lush tropical garden slowly materialized around me, I knew who the dream's creator was even before she appeared. "Hello, Sonia," I said. She emerged from behind a honeysuckle bush, wearing casual gardening clothes, but with her red hair immaculately styled.
"Adrian," she said, by way of greeting. "You're hard to find in sleep these days. I can't tell what schedule you're on."
"Not much of any," I admitted. "Haven't had much sleep, really. We've been busy."
"I've gathered as much. Rumor has it the alchemists know you left court now."
"Afraid so." I leaned against a palm tree. "You could have called if you wanted to talk." She nodded.
"I know, but I wanted to chat face to face. There was also something you could only see in a dream. Or rather, someone."
It took me a moment to realize what she meant.
"Nina."
Sadness filled Sonia's features.
"Yes. Her waking condition hasn't changed very much. She's not exactly comatose, but she's also not particularly responsive. If you put food in front of her, she'll eat it. Turn on a shower, she'll stand under it. But she makes few decisions that aren't initiated for her, and she never talks. The shock of that news made me reel, and I used a small bit of spirit to create a bench to sit on. "Is there any hope for improvement?" I asked. "I don't know." Sonia sat beside me. "I mean, I'm praying there is. I never want to say there's no hope, but that spirit overload, it was too much, with too little preparation. She was in such a fragile state already from excessive use, and in no way prepared to handle what she summoned. The scarring from it was formidable." My heart plummeted. I should have stopped her somehow. "I don't think you could have, Adrian. She was intent on doing whatever she thought she had to do to find her sister." I hesitated, almost afraid to speak my next words. "I found her. I found Olive and learned why she ran. But, well, the story doesn't exactly have a happy ending." Sonia didn't press me for details. "I'm not sure I'd tell her that." "Tell her?" I asked. "Yes, that's part of the reason I wanted to talk to you. When Nina wouldn't respond in person, I tried reaching her in spirit dreams. That didn't work either at first. Then I was able to, in a way. I'll show you." She fell silent and stared off at a clearing in the garden. After several moments of intense concentration, a huge rectangular block of stone appeared. A small opening was cut into it, but that opening was covered in bars. I stood up and peered inside, gasping at what I saw. Nina sat there in the small stone cell on the floor, wrapped in shadows. "Nina!" I exclaimed. She stared off at the stone wall, saying nothing, her face expressionless. "Nina? Can you hear me?" Sonia came to stand beside me. "I think she can, but I just don't think she's capable of responding." I gestured to the portable stone prison around her. "Where did this come from?" "Her mind," replied Sonia. "This is how she sees herself, trapped. But honestly, the fact that she appears this way at all is promising. Before, there wasn't enough of her mind to form any sort of connection with. I'm hoping in time that she'll advance further, so I try to talk to her either in person or in dreams. I thought you'd like to know, in case you want to visit as well." "I do," I said, still coming to terms with the shock I felt at her condition. Even while imprisoned and tortured, Sydney's mind had remained strong enough to connect at the spirit dream level. What kind of damage had been done to Nina to put her in this state? Was this the danger I was courting with my continued spirit use? "I think it's good for different people to talk to her," said Sonia carefully. "But I think certain topics are best avoided until she's recovered, like unhappy endings." She didn't need to elaborate for me to understand. Knowing the truth, that Olive was dead, was probably not going to be therapeutic for Nina's immediate recovery. I nodded and stepped back up to the stone cell's window. "I'm glad to see you again, Nina. There's so much I want to tell you. A lot of it's about Olive, and some of it's really incredible." I smiled as Declan came to mind. "You're definitely going to want to hear about it, so you need to come back to us soon, okay?" There was no response or change of expression, not even at the mention of Olive's name. "It'll take time," said Sonia, gently touching my arm. "But all of this helps." "Thank you for letting me know about her," I said. As my gaze shifted back to Sonia, it hit me that she too would probably be very interested in knowing about Declan. I didn't know for certain, but I had a sneaking suspicion that the way spirit was infused in him was exactly the feat she was trying to replicate for her vaccine. If she could see him, she might make incredible progress, and yet that was exactly what Olive had been trying to avoid. It was what she'd died for. "What is it?" asked Sonia, seeing my scrutiny. I gave her a weak smile. "Nothing. There's just a lot going on." "I can imagine, and I won't keep you. I just wanted you to know Nina's progress and see how you could talk to her." "Thanks," I said, giving Sonya a small hug. I'll keep checking in with her. Let me know if she wakes in the real world. The dream dissolved, and I returned to my own sleep, surprising myself when I slept into almost noon at Howie's. When I woke, another meal of junk food followed. I'd never wanted a salad so much in my life. I also learned from Marcus that Sabrina had sent an update from the Warriors' compound. They were all inside and safe, and so far, their cover was holding. That news got me through the day until evening came around, and an unknown car pulled up outside our safe house. I could see Marcus starting to freak out until I recognized Neil in the driver's seat. "Jackie Terwilliger sent me to fetch you," he explained. "I helped get her out earlier and shake the alchemists who were watching her house. She's getting things ready for Alicia now." At the mention of Alicia's name, his expression darkened. She had that effect on people. "I'm kind of surprised I get to be the lucky one to witness her interrogation," he added. "But with Eddie off on some mission and Rose and Dimitri doing something mysterious at Clarence's, I'm the only free guardian around." "Did you talk to Rose and Dimitri?" I asked casually. "I saw them," said Neil, "and your mum. I stopped by this morning. That's a cute little fellow she's taking care of, by the way. Is he part of the reason Rose and Dimitri are sticking around? I got the impression Rose really would have liked to come with me." I hesitated. Neil still didn't know that he was a father, or that the girl he loved was dead. It was a huge, burning secret he deserved to know, but again, I was struck by the poor timing. I certainly wasn't going to bring it up in front of Marcus, and it didn't really seem right to mention it as a by the way en route to interrogating Alicia. "It's a long story," I said simply. "I'll fill you in later." "Fair enough," said Neil. Guardians were used to secrets and a need-to-know basis. He could take it in stride, though he also didn't realize that this secret hit so close to home. I told Marcus to keep me updated as soon as he learned anything about Sydney and Eddie's progress at the Warriors' compound. After stocking up on a few snacks from Howie's kitchen, though honestly I was kind of sick of it all by now, Neil and I headed back to the civilization of Palm Springs. Along the way, he mentioned that he'd heard Nina was sick, and I again had to tread very carefully about the extent of my involvement. Naturally, Neil also wanted to know if I'd obtained any news of Olive, especially in light of her sister's condition. I played it vague, saying I hadn't been able to make contact, hating that I had to lie to him. Disappointment showed in his face, and I realized I was going to hate having to tell him the truth as well, at least about Olive. I soon learned from him that we were going to the home of Maud, the Stell's leader. Not only was she not under alchemist surveillance, she also apparently had a bona fide dungeon in her house. At least that's what Inez told me when we arrived. Maud, overhearing as she passed by, rolled her eyes. "It's not a dungeon, Inez, it's a wine cellar." We were standing in Maud's living room, waiting for a few other coven members to show up. Inez sniffed in contempt.
"It's underground and has stone walls," she retorted. "And it doesn't have wine racks."
"I haven't gotten them installed yet," explained Maud.
"I just call it like I see it," said Inez.
Jackie strolled over to us.
"Well, regardless, it's incredibly useful right now. Underground rooms are excellent for containing magic. We can create a circle to prevent Alicia from attempting anything nefarious, and then you can work your own brand of magic, Adrian. Ah, here are the others."
A few more newcomers entered, bringing the total number of witches up to 14. According to Jackie, there were a bunch of sacred numbers in spellcraft, but to offer the best protection against Alicia, a circle of 13 was needed, as well as someone to work other spells. After 2 days in that frozen form, Alicia was probably weakened, but after all the times she'd surprised us, no one wanted to take any chances. With everyone here, we headed down into the basement. There, I found Alicia frozen in exactly the same form she'd been at Wolf's. I also found myself agreeing with Inez.
"It is kind of dungeon-esque," I murmured to her.
"Who uses stone this dark for a wine cellar? I'd expect something more Tuscan."
"I know, right?"
she whispered back. 13 witches linked hands and formed a circle of protection around Alicia, chanting spells that would supposedly keep all human magic locked inside. Maud, separate from the circle, then used the same herbs and incantations that had freed Eddie at Wolf's compound. Staring at Alicia, frozen in the awkward defensive position Sidney had trapped her in, I couldn't help but suddenly share in the witch's initial reluctance to free her. She'd tried to kill Sidney, steal Jackie's power, and left Jackie's sister in a coma. She'd also captured Jill and turned her over to the warriors, simply as a way to get back at Sidney. Really, Alicia deserved to be left a statue forever. But then we'd never get answers. Maud's spell completed, and as it did, she slipped outside the circle to stand by Neil and me. We watched as Alicia came to life again, her legs buckling as the muscles suddenly had to learn to function once more. Yet even as she crumpled to the floor, a snarl crossed her features, and she held up her hand, sending bolts of light out from her. They hit an invisible wall formed by the 13 and dissipated harmlessly.
"You can't hold me forever," she cried, "and as soon as I'm free again, I'll make all of you pay."
I leaned toward Maud, pitching my voice low. "She has a point. What will happen to her?"
"Don't worry," she murmured back. "Just as you, Maroi, have your own prisons, we have ours."
Clearing her throat, she stepped forward so that she remained outside of the circle, but was still in Alicia's field of vision.
"What happens to you now will depend on how cooperative you are, Alicia. We can make life comfortable as you're brought to justice, or very unpleasant."
Alicia expressed what she thought of that by sending a fireball in Maud's direction. It, too, was absorbed, and I thought she should consider herself lucky their protective wall didn't bounce things back to her. Maud crossed her arms and regarded Alicia unflinchingly.
"We understand you played a part in the disappearance of a young Maroi girl. Tell us where you took her."
For a moment, Alicia looked surprised at the question, until she noticed me standing off to the side of the circle. She chuckled.
"Where is Sidney? Is she too afraid to face me again?" "Don't let her talk to you like that," ordered Aunt Tatiana.
With a small amount of spirit telekinesis, I made Alicia's arms suddenly snap against her sides, as though she were in a straitjacket. Her eyes widened in astonishment when she tried to lift them and couldn't.
"Sidney has more skill and integrity than you ever will," I said. "You're lucky you won't have to face her again. Now tell us where you took Jill. We know she's with the warriors. Where?"
"Tell us, and we'll send you off to your trial as a well-treated prisoner," added Maud. "Otherwise, we'll put you back in that inert state."
"It'll take more than threats or parlor tricks to get me to tell you where she's at."
Alicia shot me a malicious grin.
"You might have caught me, but that's one battle Sidney won't win. You'll never see that Maroi brat again." "If she hurts Jill..."
Aunt Tatiana didn't finish her threat, and she didn't need to. Anger, fueled by my raging aunt, welled up in me, and I forcibly pushed it down, needing a cool head. "Enough games," I said. I released her arms and redirected my spirit into compulsion. "Tell us where Jill is." Alicia's eyes started to glaze over, her jaw going slack. Then, amazingly, she shook it off. Her features hardened again.
"I'm not that easy to control," she said.
"She may have bolstered herself with potions," Maud told me. Jackie had hinted at this as well, that Alicia might very well have given herself all sorts of magical protection, including against compulsion. "It won't last forever. A few more days and it should all be gone." I gritted my teeth and upped my spirit use. "No, we're getting answers today." With renewed magic, I focused on Alicia again. "Tell us where Jill is." Again, Alicia looked defiant, but this time she had more difficulty standing against me.
With the warriors."
"We know that," I said. "Where? Where are they holding her?" Trying to compel her was like trying to open a door that someone was pushing back against on the other side. Both of us were throwing all we had into it. Her will and whatever potion she'd taken were strong, but I believe my powers were stronger. Again, I increased the amount of spirit channeling through me, knowing that an average-willed person would have been bent to my will by now. Sidney's warnings echoed back to me about not going crazy with spirit use, but I pushed on anyway. We needed answers. "Where are the warriors holding her?" I demanded. Alicia was visibly sweating now, fighting hard against my power.
In Utah, she blurted out at last. St. George, a compound there. But you'll never get to her. You'll never get through to her.
Why? I asked.